Welcome to the show, friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm kind of coming off of a pretty cool weekend here and still excited about the wonderful reality that we had in Minneapolis last weekend. I actually went in on Friday. Now, make that I went in on Wednesday, a day early, because I had to make a trip into Wisconsin. You don't know how painful it is to drive from Minneapolis to Tomahawk, which is 30 miles south of our cabin, sign a bunch of bank papers, and without going 30 miles north to visit our place, I had to turn around and drive back another 4 hours, 8 hours of driving on Thursday just to get the bank work done. But I had to get to Minneapolis and the rethink that we had there. What a great turnout it was. This is a massive church. I mean, I don't know that I've been in a bigger church than this. I think they hold about 4,500 students. Now, of course, because of COVID, I should say the politics of COVID, and it's hard to know where to draw the line between genuine health concerns and the politics. But in any event, without getting into that, because of that, we are restricted to only 1,500 people there at Reality, and we just about filled it up in terms of signups. But then we had a drop off of 100 people or so because folks got sick or they got exposed to someone who is sick, and so they had to stay home. But many of them went for the online option and were able to participate in the bulk of the event, which was magnificent. That's all I can say. I think it was one of the best realities / rethinks we have ever had. And so many people there and in the overflow rooms and excited. The speakers, fabulous, as usual. In fact, I was just thinking in our kind of, hate to call it a postmortem. What do you call it afterwards? A better way of looking at it. When you reassess how the day and the weekend went, you know, not a postmortem because nobody was dead. They were more alive than ever. But as we were reflecting, a comment came from the leaders of the local church there of how great our speakers are. We had Drew Worsham, who is doing the emceeing and part of the emceeing, I should say. We had another MC from the local church that was great. His name was Zane. We had Drew, who does these illusions that are unbelievable, man. It's just, he says, hey, it's just a trick. And, but you can't figure out how he does it. We had Jay Warner Wallace. We had Alan Schliemann. We had Alisa Childers on the main stage. We had Sean McDowell. I mean, these were our plenary sessions and then workshops, which I did too on tactics, and others did others. Jonathan Noyce did just a fabulous job on suicide, and there was a session there on doubt. Bobby Conway did that, our last session with Jay Warner Wallace, and kind of interview style. People loved it, and we are not scheduled right now for our Dallas one, where this would be repeated in our Central South reality in that kind of general area. But I'll tell you what, since we got canceled out for this year just because of all the stuff, you know, but we are having some conversations with some people in the Oklahoma City area. And maybe I'm not supposed to be talking about this right now because we don't have anything secured down yet. But if you're in that area, this is what you can be praying about, because we'd love to reprise this again in the spring and do this great reality that we just did. But in that Central South area, but not in Dallas, just a little bit north. But it was fabulous. That's all. It was just fabulous. The theme was Truth Is Not Ice Cream. And I kicked off with about a 4 or 5 minute little introduction. And my introduction was very simple and very straightforward. And I told the audience something that I have mentioned to many audiences before, and I'm virtually certain I've talked about it here on the program. And that was an account of a conversation I had with my daughter, my 15-year-old, who's almost 16, when she was about 8 years old, and she asked me a question. And she said, Papa, how do we know that God is true, is the way she put it. How do we know that God is true? In other words, how do we know that we're on the right track here with Christianity, believing in God and Jesus and the whole deal? Now, that was her fairly simple way of putting it. And, of course, this is the kind of question I get asked on or have to address on a fairly regular basis. That is the truthfulness of the Christian worldview or Christian theism. And I do that with adults principally. And here I have my 8-year-old at the time who is asking me this question. And now I got to think about how I'm going to communicate this in a way that will make sense to her. And as I thought about it for a few moments, something came to mind, a line came to mind that represents now, as I look back on it, really my entire approach to making the case for Christian theism over and above the other alternatives, in particular and more broadly, I guess, the larger worldview alternatives like atheism or naturalism or materialism. I put those all in the same category because generally they fit together. Physicalism might be a term that fits right in there because atheism is the idea that there is no God. And by the way, it is not a lack of belief in God. That's not what atheism is. It does entail the idea that the atheist lacks a belief in God, but they don't lack a belief about God. They are not without belief regarding the subject. They have a very firm conviction about it, a belief, and that belief is that God does not exist, that when it comes to God, there is none. That is a belief. When I say belief, I don't mean mere belief. Maybe they have reasons for it, but a belief is just holding that something is so, and that is one of those things. And people don't write books about non-beliefs, and they don't hold lectures and have debates about non-beliefs. They talk about their beliefs, in this case, atheists, a belief that God does not exist, which means they have no belief in God, but they do have a belief about God. But as I think about making our case against the materialistic, atheistic, physicalistic, naturalistic worldview, that is, if there is no God, it's just a physical world, material world that's run by natural laws, and it's a closed system of cause and effect. Okay, well, the concept makes sense. Or maybe some other kind of worldview that I call matterism in the book Story of Reality, and another alternative would be that there is no matter, it's only mind, and that would be mindism, according to my terminology, or classically called monism, one-ism. Only one thing that exists, and that one thing is a unity. Well, that's classic Hinduism, Vedantic Hinduism, so that's kind of the Eastern alternative. And when the Christian worldview is put up against either of those, I have a way of thinking about how I make a defense. And this is what I told my daughter. I said, honey, the reason that we believe that God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. The reason that we believe God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. Now, that phrase, like I said, captures my entire approach to making a defense for Christianity. And indeed, I think it captures the notion of explanatory power, which is a phrase that's often used in the scientific enterprise. And so what we do is we observe in science in the physical world, because science deals with the physical material world, at least the way it's characterized now. It was much more expansive in the past, in the distant past. Science was more had to do with all of reality. But let's just, in this view, metaphysical naturalism, all of reality is physical. So now the discipline of science is confined to this naturalistic realm. But what we do is we observe something. And then we ask the question, why does that happen that way? Human beings ask these questions all the time. Why? And then we come up with possible answers based on the kind of thing we're observing. Well, maybe this is what caused that, or here's another alternative that caused that, or maybe here, and you come up with, sometimes you're just guessing, sometimes you've got some indication, sometimes you're doing your best reflection based on your intuitive knowledge about how the world works or the way the world works, and you give it a shot. And when you have competing explanations for the effect one sees in the world, common sense dictates that you go with the best explanation for the way things are. That is, the explanation that seems to have the most explanatory power. And this is a common sense epistemic notion, a notion of how we acquire knowledge, epistemology. And we employ it every day. So if we hear a big explosion type noise, we don't settle for an explanation when someone says, "Well, oh, that big bang that you heard, I dropped a needle on the carpet." Because that does not seem to be a very good explanation for the effect that needs to be described or explained. And so what you do is you look around for these explanations. You come up with the best you can do, but if it doesn't seem adequate, you keep trying to refine it. Okay, and that's how the whole process of gaining knowledge in our lives work. It's explicitly part of the scientific procedure for determining knowledge about how the material physical universe works, but we use it in all kinds of other ways as well. Explanatory power, it's very simple, accessible, intuitive way of learning about causes. And when I say intuitive, we didn't have to learn this in school. We trade on it. We get better at it through our educational process, hopefully. But this is something that is a common sense notion, okay? And it just seems to fit. It's I think it's kind of built in, all right? Okay, so what I told my daughter is and I told the audience this weekend, that what we were trying to demonstrate in a conference like this, and it's actually what we do in virtually every conference that we're involved in, all right? And that is we're trying to make sense out of our world, especially the things that are most important. We're trying to infer deeper meaning and deeper significance, if there is any, in the world in which we live, because our hearts are asking these kinds of questions. In the 60s, there was a song called "What's It All About, Alfie?" Is it just for this moment that we live? Okay, well, it's kind of a corny song, but it sounded good back then. It sounds weird now when I sing it in my head. But the point is that we existentially, in terms of our experience and our internal struggle trying to make sense of our world, this is what we ask. What is it all? Is there an all about it? Or is it just a matter of whatever, molecules clashing in the universe? And the only thing that the world is about for me is what I decide that it's about. That's kind of the existentialist approach. What's it all about? Well, their answer is nothing. It's nihilistic nothingism. There is no meaning. So how do we live meaningfully? We adopt our own meaning for ourselves. And frankly, that's all that's left. If there is no higher meaning, there can be lower meaning. When you have agents who ascribe meaning to life or to their lives, to put it more accurately. But of course, the problem with that is, since it is subject-oriented, meaning for my life as an individual subject, not meaning out there, not meaning from the outside, only meaning from the inside, then whatever meaning a person has for himself from the inside is all that you can say, I guess. That's it. You can't take it any further. I have my meaning, you have yours. I can't say mine is good and yours is bad because that requires some kind of external meaning that we use to assess the legitimacy of our internal meanings. There's just internal meanings, that's all. C.S. Lewis said something to the effect of, I would know something was crooked, instead I knew of what was straight. But in this case, if there is no straight meaning for the universe, what's it all about? All about, it's not about, there is no straight, so there cannot be any sense of crookedness. There is just differentness. And so Mother Teresa had her meaning for her, and Hitler had his meaning for him. I'm on about page 350 now of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I'm in 1938. They're just poised to take Czechoslovakia. They just took Austria without a shot, without firing a shot, without losing a man. Soldier here. Actually, some died, but not in the military conflict. It was rather the oppressive totalitarianism that resulted from the Nazi takeover of Austria. And the French and the British did nothing. And so that's why now he's got Czechoslovakia virtually surrounded by Germany and Austria. He can just take a chomp out of that too, knowing that everybody was going to do nothing. All right. And I mention this because when there is no higher meaning, when there is nothing out there of meaning, there is no external objective standard to what it's all about, then it's all about whatever a powerful person wants to make it. Now, we are, in my view, and I'm not alone in this, seeing a rise in totalitarianism in this culture. And I'm not going to get super political about this. I'm just saying, look around. Just look around. When there could be a major news story that comes out of the mainstream media that Twitter completely puts the kibosh on, because it doesn't like it, it doesn't fit with it. That's totalitarianism. It's a soft totalitarianism. It's not coming from the government, but it's still a squash of the transfer of important, relevant news. And when one side controls all the news, not good. You know, in 1984, there's a interesting quote. Now, this is a book that when it was written by George Orwell was futuristic. 1984 is a long time ago. What, 35 years ago, something like that. My math isn't so good when I have to cross a millennium, but something like that, 84, 94, 2004. Yeah, 35. So that was written a long time before that, anticipating some totalitarian type world that he was a little premature on, but we're moving more and more towards something like that. And here's one thing that was said in that book that Orwell wrote. He said, if you control the past, you control the future. What people believe about the past controls what they will think about the future. That's his point. And then he added, and the one who controls the present controls the past. Control the present, you control the past, you control the past, you control the future. And what he's speaking there to is the issue of rewriting history. There's a lot of that going on now too. Again, I don't have time to get into all these details, but many of you know what I'm talking about. And when the past is rewritten by those in power in the present, they control the future, is the point. Okay, now why am I bringing all this up? Because it all has to do with ultimate issues, doesn't it? It has to do with the best explanations for the way things are. And if what we do when we look at the world the way it is, and we say there is no meaning to it, what's it all about? It's not all about anything. Then it's just a matter of individual power, allowing people or groups of people to get their way. And that's all it's about, not anything transcendent, just something selfish. Now, I think that we know somewhere deep down inside that something is wrong with that. And therefore, the worldview that results in nihilism about big meaning cannot be true, because in our heart we know differently. Now, I was actually thinking about taking this reflection in a different direction in my opening comments than I have, because there are four different things that are the most salient details of the nature of this world that we are all aware of, that I think Christian theism explains, that materialism, atheism, cannot begin to explain. In fact, they have to deny most of them, and that's part of what I was getting at a moment ago. There's the existential concern. What's it all about? It's not about anything. It's all just whatever. But something deep down inside of us, and by the way, that is part of the world. Our native intuitions about the nature of reality, something deep down inside of us says that's just not true. There is more here than just meets the eye, quite literally. Empiricism is all about what meets the eye, but there's more to the world than the physical universe. There's more to the world than what meets the eye. We know that. And we are hungering for an explanation for that. And this is an explanation that materialism cannot provide, even in principle. In fact, in principle, it denies such a thing. Everything is individual. Everything is subjective. All meaning, all purpose, all morality. It's all reduced to teeny weeny individual human beings. Now, I think those human beings are infinitely valuable, but that's because I don't believe that value is just reduced to teeny weeny individual human beings who make up their definition as they go along. They're valuable transcendently because of something bigger outside of them. And that's a central part of Christian theism. And that is something that atheism completely denies. And that's one of the reasons why Christianity or Christian theism is the best explanation for the way things are. I'm looking at the clock. I've been jabbering for a bit, so let's take a break, and I'll get to your calls after this. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason.
Pop Christian culture has fueled an insidious habit that's leading to biblical illiteracy. I call it coffee cup Christianity. Find out its harm in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or the top of the homepage at str.org.
What does a bushel of corn and a 2002 Dodge Neon have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. There are some really creative ways to support STR financially. You can easily give items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, and gift cards through STR's partnership with iDonate. iDonate takes care of selling the items and then gives the proceeds to STR. You can also give through the purchases you're already making on Amazon. Visit Amazon Smile and select Stand to Reason as your charity of choice. Amazon will then donate a portion of what you spend. You'll find all the information on creative ways to give by going to str.org/donate. Donation questions link at the bottom of the page will give you all the information you need. That's str.org/donate.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
Greg Kolkel back at you here, giving you a piece of my mind on the show. And if you want to call in, you can do so. The number is 855-243-9975. That's the kind of national number. If you are calling internationally, dial 1 and then 562-424-8229. And in either case, you'll that number will get you to Amy Hall, the infamous – she's not infamous. She's famous. Because she's well known for good things, not bad things. Do you know the difference between those words, infamous and famous? Okay, infamous is like bad. Famous is good. Amy's famous. She'll take your call and pass you on to me. Incidentally, just had a notification. It was Amy. They were telling you about the STR speakers, John Noyes being our newest speaker on Standard. He does a great job on the issue of suicide. And it is one of the most popular workshops that we have at I almost said Rethinks, at Realities. I'm still getting used to the new name. And, I mean, people just, man, flock to this. It is amazing how big a deal this is with young people. I mean, it's amazing for me. Maybe not amazing for many of you who work or are closer with young people. It's talk about pandemic. That's huge. And thank God we have John that can speak to it from a thoughtful and gracious and sensitive but biblical perspective. That means if you'd like to have John address your group on that issue, I'm not sure the actual title of his talk. I think it might be When Hope Runs Out. When Hope Runs Out, but it's dealing with that issue. And just contact booking@str.org. Don't really like that email address. We're not rock stars. We're just people that want to help. booking@str.org for any of us. But just highlighting John right now for his great talk on suicide, When Hope Runs Out. All right, let's go to the callers, and I have Michael here in Cleveland, Ohio. Michael, hey.
Hello, Greg. How are you today, my
I'm doing all right.
Brother and friend. Awesome.
I'm doing
awesome. Well, I wouldn't go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would just say I'm doing okay. Just like I said, I'm coming down in a good way from our good weekend there in Minneapolis. And then I get home. I've been gone for 5 days, and I got a pile of mail I got to deal with. So that's good news, bad news. But anyway, nice to have you on board, Mike.
No, it's really a pleasure to actually officially speak with you the first time. I'm a little nervous, so I can hopefully I can get through these questions.
No worries. You sound great.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to just thank you for all the hard work you and your team over the years. I came across STR maybe about 7-8 years ago. I was exploring my faith a little bit deeper. I grew up in a Pentecostal tradition, and mm-hmm. I just wanted something a little bit deeper than what I was getting in church. So thank you very much for all the work that you and your team have been doing over the years, and it's been very helpful as I continue to grow in it, right?
Well, you're welcome, Michael. I'm really glad to hear that. That's what we're here for. We're here for you.
So my question is, if you were to ask me, you know, Michael, what do you want to be when you grow up? Again, growing up in church all my life, mm-hmm. I would have told you either a pastor, I would have told you a teacher, or I would have said a pediatrician just to make my mom happy. And now fast forward, I'm 40 now. And, you know, life happens. Mm-hmm. My world is not all about the church anymore, whereas before I was day in, day out of church all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm literally following my uncle everywhere who was a pastor or is a pastor at that time. But right now, my attention has really grown within the more secular sphere as far as a vocation within the secular world, specifically with economic development. And so what I'm seeking from you right now is just some wisdom. Again, I want to definitely grow in my walk with God and Christ. Right. But I also want to be excellent in what I do at work as well, too.
Sure.
And then before, it's always reading the Bible and reading books about apologetics or spirituality or whatever the case may be. But I'm finding myself now reading a lot of books about economic development or reading about economics. And it's trying to find that balance. I don't want to lose touch with Christ, but at the same time, I want to be excellent in what I do.
Yeah.
Work. So it's just really trying to figure out where is that balance? Where do you feel like, I know you yourself, you're full time in ministry. You read the Bible, you have to read it every day and read the books about apologetics. But I'm finding myself trying to make sure that I still hold on to that. But at the same time, you know, finding time and room to grow in my secular profession as well. So just need some guidance. Hopefully that makes sense.
No, that's a great question. No, it makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of folks are listening and asking themselves the same question. And I have some thoughts for you, but I don't know that they're going to be especially profound. Let me just offer a couple of responses to the things that you said. First of all, me being in full-time ministry, you said I have to read my Bible every day and read apologetics books. And well, there is a certain sense that study is important, obviously, in Scripture. You have to know the truth before you can defend the truth. And it is also true that as different things come up, I need to be well-informed on those things, like we have now this wave of critical race theory, CRT, or critical theory, depending on how you characterize it, that social Marxism. Well, these things are influencing a lot of people, and I want to make sure that I'm not speaking out of my ken, as it were, when I'm dealing with these issues. So, yeah, our team has to be up on these kinds of things. But I will tell you, quite frankly, and entirely genuinely, I don't read the Bible every day, first of all. And I, when I do, I'm going to qualify that in a moment, but when I do, I don't do it for my business. I don't do it for my professional life, okay? I try to read the Bible daily, and I have a system that I use, and I don't always read it. I mean, if I'm traveling, maybe I get on the airplane and I start to read at 0:30 in the morning, leaving LAX for the East Coast, and I open my Bible, and 10 minutes later, I'm asleep, you know, because I had to get up so early. But it's okay, you know, maybe before I go to sleep at night, I'll read. And I do have this pattern, and maybe you know, that I work through the entire Bible. And then when I finish it, like I did a couple of months ago in July, I start all over again and I have a little, you know, I check off the boxes, whatever. I have a guide that I use, and I've talked about that before. But I don't follow it in a certain sense religiously. What I mean is I can jump around, and if I want to just move to the New Testament instead of stay in the old, whatever's not on the schedule, I just jump ahead and read that and then check it off. You know, so I got checks in April and checks, you know, in December or whatever. It doesn't matter to me as long as I'm continuing to read. And if I have to read something for my own encouragement, like 1 Peter is great about suffering. So if I'm thinking I just need encouragement, I'm going to spend time in 1 Peter, even if I've already checked it off. All right. But then I'm going to go back and, okay, where can I read today that I can just keep moving? And eventually the whole sheet gets checked off and I'm done. Let me tell you why I do that. It's because I'm a Christian and I need to be reminded about what reality is like. I need to be reminded. And the reason is because, and you know this just as a professional, and this is true of everybody, the world is evangelizing and discipling every bloody second of every day. In every place we turn, and I know this is going to sound like a little crazy, and I don't know if I would have said this like 15 years ago because it just sounds so extreme, but I'm just getting older and I'm getting a little crankier and I don't care, all right? There are lies everywhere. Everywhere I turn, I hear lies. But the reason I know they're lies is because I know what the truth is, and I can see the lies coming in very subtly. More than ever before, I can see the subtleness of the lie, okay, the subtlety of the lie. How do I know that? Because over the years I have become well informed, I think, by a biblical worldview. Okay, so now in practical terms, this means, I imagine your life is like mine. I mean, in my case, when I'm home, I don't always have to get up to an alarm clock. So I can kind of wake up at 8 or whatever instead of at 6 and go to work. I wake up at 8 and then I get my coffee and a slice of cheddar cheese and I sit down and I maybe have some time with the Lord. Now, if I'm in the airplane, it doesn't look like that. And this last weekend when I was in Minneapolis for reality, it didn't look like that because I got up real early and went to work. And then when I got back, it's like 11:30 at night or something. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to lay down. I like to read a little bit before I go to bed. Just kind of relaxes me. I'm going to open the Word and read half a chapter or something, maybe move a little further ahead. But you see, I'm just trying to keep feeding myself regardless of the nature of my schedule, I don't want to say legalistically because I want to say not rigidly. It's flexible, but it's regular. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like mealtimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you travel, you don't eat like morning, noon, and night at the same time as you do when you're at home. You pick it up here and there, but you still eat. And maybe you don't eat all day, but then you eat something more at night. So there's a kind of flexibility there. But my recommendation is that you make Bible reading a regular part of your life. And that you read the whole counsel of God. And so you get one of these, you know, read the Bible through in a year kind of thing where you check the boxes off. And it takes me 3.5 years. It's all right. Doesn't matter. I'm working through it. And this is what tells me what reality is about. When I'm facing a tough – sometimes I'm reading something for my own spiritual life. So I read about John Newton's life, for example, Lloyd-Jones's life, you know, these great saints of the past, and I read things that encourage me, okay? I'm also reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I mean, that's a big difference between Newton and Hitler, right? But I'm trying to get wise as to how fallen people secure power and manipulate and enslave others. And that's happening today not to the extreme, obviously, of the Third Reich, but the same kinds of things are happening. They follow certain patterns. So notice how my reading is going to – it's professional and it's personal. So your reading is going to be about economics. One thing that you need to do, by the way, if you're working in econ, is you got to read Jay Richards' book on God, Money, and Capitalism or something like that. And the reason I recommend that is because it will give you – in your field, it will help tutor you about a Christian way of looking at money and the economy and stuff like that. And Jay's really good at that. There are other books too. In a certain sense, what I've said is not anything you haven't heard before. But read your word, whatever. But hopefully I'm telling it to you in a way that you can sink your teeth into it a little bit more. The same is true of prayer. The scripture says you have not because you ask not, all right? Or you have not because you ask and have wrong motives. Okay, so there's a couple things we got to watch on. But the one thing I don't want God to ever say to me, you know that thing that you wanted? You didn't get that. Why not? You didn't ask for it.
Right.
Now, I'll be honest with you, Michael. I don't get most of the things I ask for. But the things that I'm asking for are – pardon me?
I said, me neither.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe that's an encouragement to you. You know, however, the things that I ask for are important. And I don't have time in my day because prayer is hard for me. But I had my prayer time at 2:00 this afternoon because all of a sudden I got pulled in this way and that way and everything like that. And I had to sit down and I read through and I read chapter 25 of Exodus and the last half of the chapter 3 of Proverbs. Okay, so there I'm getting wisdom in there. I'm getting stuff. And what's chapter 25? I mean, this is like how you build the ark. I mean, the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, who cares about that? But it's God's word, and so I care about it. And I read slowly. I do not read fast. I read the biblical text slowly with a pencil in my hand, and I make marks. All right, so this is a way that I get fed regardless of what I do for a living. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, that's kind of professional reading, so to speak, for me.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Live Not by Lies. That's professional reading for me right now. John Newton stuff, that's for personal, because I want to be personally fed. So your professional reading and my professional reading will be different. Sometimes you're just interested in some topic, like a Christian topic, and so you'll take some time off and just read something for fun, and you can work that in there. But what's going to be really critical is just having a consistent pattern of imbibing from the Word thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. Don't read fast. If it's three chapters for one day and you're blitzing through it, read one chapter slowly, not three. Mm-hmm. You got the rest of your life. You know, don't blitz through it to check the box off, because what you want to do is get fed, you know, and by reading through, your mind isn't even engaging, so you're not going to get fed. And then the prayer part, pray about what's important and pray directly to God. I got really bugged at myself today. And the reason I got bugged a bunch of times when I was in prayer is my mind was kind of running off because I started late and I needed to get going with other projects. I had to get ready for the show. And what I end up doing is I find myself babbling religious phrases to God. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, stop. Oh, stop. Mm-hmm. Boy, that bugs me. Okay, God, I'm sorry. I'm just babbling. Wait, here is what I want to say. Please help Ocean get better from her sciatica problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, Lord? Great. Next, yeah. So in other words, I just, mm-hmm. rather than babble with religious nonsense, I'd rather just say it plainly and move on, because God doesn't, it's a request. It's a genuine request. So I'm trying to make my prayers authentic and genuine and meaningful. They don't have to be all really long for every person. All right. I have an acquaintance who's lost a son, and God bless him and his wife. A well-known person, actually, many may know Tim Challies. I guess it's a public thing that he lost his son a couple of weeks ago. I'm praying for Tim and his wife, Aileen, and that God bring mercy on them. And I pray, Lord, bring mercy, put your arms around that family, and my heart is with them when I pray, and I move on. I don't try to keep blabbling. All right. So the two things there, being in the Word and praying genuinely and thoughtfully about things that matter before God, are the most important things that I would suggest for you right now.
Thank you. Yes.
Oh, I just thought of one other thing, if you have time.
I do.
Clock. Okay. The one other thing here, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this. Maybe I have. I have a notebook, like it's a bound thing. You know how you buy them and it's a book with nothing in there? It's got a little, a little ribbon that you can placeholder so you can take notes, like make a diary. It's like it's not an 8.5 by 11. It's a smaller format. It's like the footprint of my Bible. And every time I go to a sermon or a talk, I take notes in that. I don't take it on the back of the announcement thing, because there's never enough room. I take notes through the whole thing. I may never look at them again, but at least I am thoughtfully engaged with the speaker enough to take notes of the outline. And then if I think of things, I can just write things down there if I want, something else that's important to me. So that has become, I think, a very good habit. And I think every Christian who goes to church ought to do that. And I mean it. I mean every Christian who goes to church. I chastised the last audience I had because I told them to turn in their Bibles, and most of the Christians didn't even have a Bible. I said, what's up with that? This is a church, man. You bring a Bible, you bring a notebook, and take notes. Sir?
We probably use the Bible app. That's probably, you're talking to a young millennial. We're using the cell phone.
Yes. Oh, by the way, Amy just reminded me that Jay Richards' title is Money, Greed, and God. Okay, just so you know, just for the record. And I can see that larger thing, Amy, better than I see that smaller thing on the other side. So thank you for that, Money, Greed, and God. And so this is the these are the recommendations I have. And these would apply to anybody, any Christian, even full-time ministry or not. I mean, it isn't like we're like walking on spiritual clouds because we're in full-time Christian work. It doesn't work that way. Michael, I promise I am no more spiritual than you are, okay? So I'm just like you, day to day, keeping up with solving problems, getting frustrated, getting bugged, trying to take things to God, trusting Him for all the goofy things that happen. But the foundation for me is regular prayer, as I described, in regular Bible reading. Not daily, because it doesn't work all the time. But I do pray short ones throughout the day when things happen. And I'll tell you one other thing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've said that like three times so far, right? One other thing is when I go to bed, I take a knee if I'm alone. If my wife's there, it looks too like I'm, you know, grandstanding or something. So I just get into bed and I lay down and close my eyes. But if she's not there, I take a knee. And I spend the time, a few minutes, just thanking God for everything that through the day that I could thank him for. Lord, thank you for getting me through the day. I mean, that's the first thing I say, basically. Thank you for the day you gave me and helping me through it, for the grace that you gave me. Thank you for being able to do the show today and to work with my team here and to talk to Michael from Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you for that. And thank you for the time I spent with my daughter. And I just try to think of the things I thank him. And by the way, when I do that, I almost always a concern comes up to me and I ended up making a short prayer and please help my daughter with XYZ or whatever. It just comes into my mind. So I say it. So it's not a big prayer time. It's just taking a knee. It's supposed to be a quickie, but sometimes it lasts 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 minutes. But it's a way of kind of just closing the day off properly with God, and it's not hard to do. If it's only 60 seconds, that's fine. Just take the knee and do that. And that has really helped to bookend my day with the Lord in a special way, and I think that helps me spiritually.
So I like that. Thank you very much. No, thank you very much. Those are some great insights that I'll definitely make sure I incorporate. I'm definitely looking to get in that book. I did see it on Amazon or somewhere like that, so I'll definitely check that one out. So
yeah, that would be for you always, professionally, right?
It's always
I'm
been
sorry,
one
I
of
cut you
situations
off.
Where, oh, no problem. No, no problem at all. So it's always been one of those situations where do I read an extra Bible verse or do I read an extra chapter in a book that I'm reading professionally? And so, mm-hmm. you know, your insights kind of help me kind of lift that burden that I have to, don't have to do it every single day religiously is the word that, you know, or rigidly is the word that you use.
Rigidly is the word you use.
Rigidly.
Mm-hmm. Not rigidly, so but regularly. And I wouldn't read a verse. Yeah, don't read a verse. Read through a passage, like a half, even if it's a half a chapter, you know, you're going to read a couple of pericopes. A pericope is like a group of verses that have to do with one thing. It's kind of like a paragraph in a certain thing. So you'd want to get the paragraph at least because you need the flow of thought. And if you don't have the flow of thought and you just read the verse, you might get in trouble. So make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. I really do appreciate your insights. Have you been out to Cleveland, Ohio? Has anyone invited? I know you only go where you're only invited.
You know, that's right. I go where I'm invited. Cleveland's up there in the northeast corner, right?
Yes.
Is that Cleveland? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got some really good smallmouth fishing right in that neck of the woods. I'm just saying. You know, so if you want to invite me out there in the spring sometime, well, y'all come out anytime. But, you know, May, that'd be great. But
all right.
You're right. I go where I'm invited and happy to do so.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate this time with you. Thank you.
You're welcome, Michael. I appreciate you too. Let me run over to Adam here in Kansas City. We got a little bit of time and we'll get to Jason later. But Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I skipped a commercial so we get to you. You're more important than the commercial.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I had a few questions, and I'm not sure, of course, if you'll be able to address all of them, but I wanted to get your perspective on these three questions.
Okay.
The first question is divine foreknowledge compatible with free will?
Okay, let's just stick with that one. I mean, if you want to explain it, fine, rather than going to the other two, and we'll just see how much time we have. So let's just start with that. Do you want to say more about it, that first question?
Of course. So it seems that, of course, simply that God knows everything that could happen
Right. Seems
to be certainly, to a sense, perhaps compatible with free will. But I think what really seems to be difficult in that sense is that God knows that if a person is placed in a certain environment and is placed in a certain cultural context, that they will turn out in a way that will ultimately make them reject God's message.
Mm-hmm. Well, he knows what they're going to do regardless of the circumstance, right?
Correct.
Yes, he knows what they would do in different circumstances. That's called middle knowledge.
Right. Yet,
okay.
It seems to be that would God create these people and put them in the best circumstances that they might thrive in, or does he simply let the world unfold naturally, and therefore these people just have the unfortunate coincidental misfortune of basically being born in a place
geographically
and a time.
Undesirable, yeah. Right.
Exactly. Well, where they would reject God's message.
Yeah, let me give that's going to take the rest of our time, just that one. And so maybe if you call back another time, we can pick up the other two, because these are really important. And different people are going to answer this question in different ways. First definition, divine foreknowledge can be used in two different ways. Divine foreknowledge could be used to as a synonym for God's omniscience. God knows everything that's going to happen. Okay. And by the way, that's the way William Lane Craig uses it most of the time. When he talks about divine foreknowledge and being foreknown, he's talking about God's omniscience, all right? And he will expand a category. Not only does God know everything that will eventuate, but he knows everything that might eventuate but doesn't had circumstances been different, okay? And that's what is called middle knowledge, okay? So we don't have to get deep into the terms, but I'm just distinguishing between two different things you mentioned. By the way, and this is what foreknowledge is taken as. However, Scripture uses the word foreknowledge in a different way. And in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 2, it says that according to the foreknowledge of God, that we were saved, essentially. I won't get into the verses for the sake of time. But then if you just look across the page, you also see that Jesus himself was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of the Christians. What foreknowledge is there is not a synonym for omniscience. It's a synonym for election. In other words, God's sovereign purpose that he accomplishes. All right. So people are foreknown. And God's purpose for Jesus is foreestablished, okay? Your question is really about the first definition. Is free will, is it reasonable or fair if God knows that somebody's going to be in a circumstance that those circumstances will not incline them towards the gospel, that is it fair for them? And this is something that different people, I said, say, I mentioned, satisfy or solve in different ways. Now, there is a verse in Acts, and I don't have it right in front of me here, but you might be familiar with it. I think it's when Paul's in Athens, and where he, maybe on the Areopagus, where he says that God has placed people in the world in such a way as they will have the best opportunity to know God if they would seek and find him, though he's not far from them. Okay, so what that suggests is God is concerned with people knowing him and maximizing the circumstances in which that's the case, that they would know him. However, there is also this other factor, and that other factor is there are people who, no matter what circumstances they're going to be in, are not going to respond to the gospel. And if they respond, if they reject the gospel, they do so, or they reject whatever knowledge of God is apparent to them. And in Romans 1, that part of the argument there is that everybody has the knowledge of the Father, even though not everybody has the knowledge of the Son. And if they reject that, they are culpable. They are without excuse. And the grounds for the judgment ultimately is going to be their immoral behavior. And we see that in Revelation 20. And they were each judged according to their deeds. So I guess to answer, to sum up real quickly here, and then you can come back at me in the last couple of minutes, is that it does. God is concerned. He does, to some degree, adjust the circumstances so people have the best opportunity to get the revelation they need. That's the Acts passage, Areopagus. But at the same time, people still are going to rebel and still not trust him. And for regardless of the level of revelation about Jesus, their rebellion is still blameworthy. And so when God punishes the unjust, I'm sorry, when he punishes the unrighteous, he is not unjust, even if no message of salvation has been given to them, because God doesn't owe guilty people a pardon. So that was my, you know, thumbnail sketch.
Okay.
To your first question. Clarification, anything?
Yes, I was going to mention now, I presume that you hold to Reformed theology. And something that's intrinsically tied to this is the idea of predestination and the elect.
Yes, that's right. I do, and it's foreknowledge in the second sense that I described that you read in 1 Peter, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So predestination with regards to salvation.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it does seem that the two are almost intrinsically tied because of God's knowledge having an effect on the elect. The salvation of people seems to come based on the circumstances that they were born in. I mean, to kind of give you an example.
You know what? Let me just respond to that because we got 30 seconds. Okay. So
sure.
And we can pick this up later at another time, but I don't think that salvation depends on where they're born in just because there's too many examples of God penetrating those circumstances and rescuing people. And so I mentioned earlier that this broader question is going to be answered different ways. William Lane Craig is going to answer it differently than I will, even though we agree on certain overlapping things, and that's what I described a few moments ago. However, one last thing to think about, and that is God's knowledge about something doesn't cause anything to happen. Knowledge doesn't cause anything to happen. It's actually that certain things are going to happen that is the ground for God's knowledge about them. So anyway, got to run here. It's so frustrated I got to let you go because there's so much more to talk about, but my music's up and the hour is done. Thank you so much for your call. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye.